Welcome to Mindvine, a mental health podcast for everyone. Since our first episode in 2016, we have been sharing stories of recovery, engaging with experts, and tackling the stigma associated with mental illness. The Mindvine podcast is produced by Ontario Shores Center for Mental Health Sciences and is available on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts.
Welcome to Mindvine, the podcast for Ontario Shore Center for Mental Health Sciences. I'm your host, Julie Van Hardingsveld, and I am so pleased to welcome our special guest, Sejal Mellon. Thank you so much for joining us here today. Our guest specializes in the science of well-being, human connection, positive transformation, and growth for both individuals and organization. She's a behavioral professor, founder of Mind Armor, and SOS Psychotherapy. In today's episode, Sejal will talk about Sejal's amazing work, which includes a series of programs, talks, and workshops on personal occupational well-being, human connection, resilience, and rising from trauma and stress. Welcome, Sejal.
Thank you.
Join us as we learn more about her mission to reduce workplace stress injuries, the loss of, and loss of life by suicide. So, you have quite the lengthy title. And in your introduction, I feel that I most certainly didn't do it justice. To get us started, perhaps you can share a little bit more with us about your role and your experience and your work in this area.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. So thank you for inviting me. My career is a very windy road. And I think, again, there's been a lot of purpose behind it. And I think it only helps to better inform the type of work that I do today. So I started with an entrepreneurial background, with a love for psychology, and found my way back to psychology, but from a management leadership perspective. And then now am teaching organizational development and behavioral sciences at a variety of colleges and universities across North America. I've developed programs for these universities as well, Canada's first positive psychology certificate program, positive education certificate program at Laurier as well. But really have landed in a place that I love, which is supporting the high-functioning who work under consistent high pressure. So whether that's CEOs, leaders, first responders, our families, I'm finding that a lot of people are finding themselves under high stress consistently, especially with the pandemic that we've just come out of. And the population that is of biggest concern for me are the high functioning, because I'm one of those people too. And I recognize that sometimes we get missed.
Definitely. So you talked about starting your career with an entrepreneurial spirit. What inspired a transition to focus or a path that specializes in occupational stress, trauma, and mental health?
I think that just stemmed from basic human compassion, to be honest. I owned my own business when I was 21, youngest franchisee in the chain at the time. And I just, my staff were really important to me. And I thought of us as a family. And I saw that a lot of us had different sort of backgrounds, different challenges, different obstacles and barriers that we were trying to manage and overcome. But how is it that we could create a culture at work where people were coming in and loved coming in? In retail, the turnover is usually 3 to 6 months. My staff stayed with me for 8 to 10 years. And many of them existed in the business even after I left. So to me, that just showed the importance of how to build cultures of connection and compassion.
Building a culture of connection and compassion, I'm sure that's something that many, many leaders would love to know a little bit more. How did they do that? Or what tactical early steps can leaders consider to help build that culture within their organization?
Yeah, I think you said it exactly right. I think a lot of leaders do want change. They just simply don't know how. And so that's what I hope to do, is to help people understand their systems, understand the nature of their work, the nature of the work that's required, what we need of their personnel. What are some of the challenges that those personnel are feeling? So that's where the organizational development and change processes really come in. The other piece, probably the biggest piece, is understanding the human aspect. Sitting together and just listening to each other, understanding where each other is coming from and how we can best support each other. Because just imagine the difference it makes that if you need something and I'm able to accommodate that, how much more connected are you going to feel, safe are you going to feel, and committed then to what you're doing in terms of the organization or your job. So imagine being able to go to work and love what you're doing and love who you're doing it with.
I had the opportunity to watch your TED Talk in preparation for this podcast, and you talk about heroic conversations. What you're sharing here, you know, there's a theme, of course, with culture, communication. How do you think leaders, whether that be in a senior capacity or perhaps even just leading teams unofficially, how do you start one of those heroic conversations, or what are the components of a heroic conversation?
I think tapping into our humanity, and some people, especially with what we've gone through, have lost what that actually is. We ourselves forget what it is because we ourselves are so stressed. So when leaders can actually start to look in the mirror first and tap into that aspects of their humanness, their vulnerabilities, and be able to tackle those first, it's then so much easier to extend that to the greater masses, their teams, their people. And then it's creating systems and procedures and policies around this kind of mindset and mentality as well.
You mentioned the word stress, and one of the general themes I took out of your TED Talk was the word occupational stress. Is there a difference between occupational stress and not just, but personal stress?
So what we're talking about there is, where is the stress stemming from? Stress is stress, and stress exists at many, many, many different levels and is exhibited and experienced many different ways. When we start talking about occupational stress, we're talking about stress that's directly tied to the working environment or the nature of the job. So occupational stress became sort of a real priority for me because through my own experiences, I couldn't figure out what was going wrong in my family. I couldn't understand because we didn't really have a lot of personal stress. My husband and I were really happy. We had a wonderful relationship, but I noticed changes and I felt something was wrong and I didn't understand where it was coming from. And I really thought it was me. I thought I was the problem because, I mean, I'm the one who's around and I was the person he was having a problem with, because that's who he would come home to. And so it's now in hindsight, you know, after sort of exploring our journey through a lot of those details that are shared in that TED Talk, that I realized that it's occupational stress. And why do any of us have to sacrifice our personal relationships or our personal happiness because of what we choose to do for a living or what we desire to do for a living? So most people in high-stress occupations don't just take it because it's high stress. They take it because they want to give back. They want to be part of the community. They want to help people. But with that same string comes being able to really understand, what does that take and how do I take care of myself while I'm doing that so I'm not sacrificing my personal life and my quality of life to do it.
When we think of occupational stress, would that be directly connected to PTSD and trauma?
Different? Yeah, so PTSD, not everybody who goes under stress gets PTSD. And PTSD is not its only outcome. We as human beings, all of us, I hope, will have post-traumatic stress. Because any human being that is exposed to something that's more overwhelming to them is going to have some sort of reaction. If you didn't have a reaction to one of the most heinous things that you've ever seen, I, you know, kind of think that maybe you have a real problem that's bigger than PTS. And PTSD is a clinical term that's used so people can access a medical system for support. It's not an end game, right? So you can have post-traumatic stress reactions, you can have post-traumatic stress injuries, and you can have post-traumatic stress disorder, which is lasting over a longer period of time. But does that mean that you have it forever? Some people will, and some people won't. Because there's also post-traumatic growth.
Thank you for defining that. I think that's really important for our listeners to understand because they are different. How can companies prioritize and support the mental health of their employees and provide resources to cope with emotional trauma or occupational stress?
I think a lot of us are going out and doing sort of like the typical things, the checkboxes that we know. Let's provide a day of training. Let's provide EAP. Let's provide some benefits that we can use. And those are all great. And those are all resources. But there's no one cookie cutter way for an organization to be able to serve the mass, right? Or organizations to all do the same thing and say that it's going to work. I think we need to look at what the culture is. Because again, I didn't have EAP in my organization. I didn't have those external resources. I just created a psychologically safe place for people to come to. Whether they experienced something at work or whether they were experiencing something at home, it was something that we could talk about, we could navigate and support. And sometimes I didn't even need to know what their problem was as much as what would be helpful. And sometimes it was really simple. Sometimes it would be just sending a meal. So it just alleviated some pressure in the evenings. Or sometimes, like I said, some of the easiest things is just tapping back into our humanity.
Psychological safety, it's a big word.
It is huge.
It's something we hear a lot. And I want to relate my question to organizations, but I think when we consider creating a psychologically safe environment, I think, I imagine the benefits could be applied in a work environment, in a home environment. Really, as humans, we talk a lot about humanity and the connection. As humans, how can we help to support or create psychologically safe environments for those people that we are with in any capacity?
Right. You know, as you're speaking again, sort of my mind went directly to my personal story with my husband, because when my husband was going through the toughest time in his life, he felt like the ugliest, unlovable person ever. And there was tremendous guilt, there was tremendous shame, all of it that was associated with it. And I had to figure out quickly how to create an environment with a 5 and 6-year-old where this person would feel loved and belonging to and feel safe. And there was a tremendous guilt because he felt he couldn't show up as a husband, couldn't show up as a father in that moment because he just didn't have that capacity. And I tried to figure out ways in which I could communicate to him that it didn't matter what he could or couldn't do or show up as, that no matter what, we were going to be there and that he could dedicate the time to his own healing and that it was quite all right. And that he could talk to me about, you know, the crap underneath his shoes. He didn't have to hide them. And really feeling loved when you feel unlovable. I think there's something really there, you know, and I know I have a lot of sort of letters after my name and there's a lot of textbook stuff and, you know, there's a lot of the change mechanisms, the psychology, the clinical, the organizational sciences that come into play. But I keep coming back to, I think you can hear the personal aspect because I really think we've lost that. We can talk about all the textbook stuff you want. We can implement all of it. But if it doesn't have that underpinning of the human aspect, of that personal aspect, it's not sustainable and it doesn't feel right.
Definitely. I think so much that you're saying will resonate with our listeners. I know it's resonating with me and so many keywords: humanity, connection, communication, culture. I had the opportunity to watch your TED Talk, which was incredible and inspiring, and I shared that when we met earlier today. But for those that are listening who maybe haven't had the opportunity to, are you comfortable sharing a little bit of your your personal experience. You talk about all of the letters after your name. I imagine, and I imagine our listeners are feeling the same, that anything thrown your way, you are prepared to deal with when it comes to emotional stress or trauma in your personal life and professional life.
I don't know if everybody would agree with that.
But I would say what really stuck out for me in your TED Talk is your vulnerability around that area. And I think that might be helpful if you're comfortable to share a little bit of
absolutely.
That story for our listeners to help position really your work, especially as it relates to first responders and the challenges that they face, especially within their roles, and then the impact to families and coworkers.
Absolutely. You know, it really comes down to, and what I remind most of the people that I work with, is it's not about the uniform we wear. It's not about how pretty we look. It's not about wearing those suits during the day or the uniforms during the day. At the end of it, we come home and we take those pieces of clothing off. And a lot of people, especially in the first responder community, don't feel that way. Yes, they take the shirt or the uniform off, but the mind doesn't turn off. The identity doesn't shift. And a lot of the people that I do work with, that's one of the things that we talk about, is remembering who they were before they started to do what they do. And I know for me, you know, you were saying that you probably could handle a lot of stuff. No, I have my days too, and I have those weeks where I'm not as high functioning as I'd like to be, you know, or maybe I'm too high functioning when I should actually be taking care of myself. I remember when Vincent went to the treatment program, we finally got him sort of that space to take care of himself. I was in bed for 2 weeks with two little kids at home. And these two little kids would get up in the morning, get themselves dressed, get themselves to the door and say, "Mommy, we're ready to go to school." I would get up from bed in my pajamas, slip on those slippers, get in the car, drive them home, or drive them to school, pick them up, bring them home, and get back into bed. And I was in bed the whole day because I just couldn't do anything else. And so I think it's really, really important for people to, again, sort of look internally and start to be their own gauges. That's what I like to teach people. I like to teach people to be more aware and sensitive and to become their own gauges, because when we are really good at understanding where we're at, what we need, and then being able to go out and get it or to take care of ourselves, we then become better equipped to offer that to the next person. And that's how we create systems of well-being and systems of psychological safety.
I like that word too, systems of well-being and psychological safety. You mentioned about taking care of yourself. So what are some signs, symptoms, behaviors that maybe unknowingly are signs that as maybe a carer or a family member of someone who has experienced some sort of emotional trauma or occupational stress or something else, what are some signs and symptoms that perhaps are demonstrating that we need to take care of ourselves?
Honestly, it exists on a spectrum. And this is why I tell people it's not cookie cutter. You really start to need to get to know yourself. So, for instance, my husband checks out. Like, he just disengages. Me, I don't turn off. And so you've got stress, two different people, totally two different ways of coping, right? And sometimes even more ways of coping, because depends on what's going on and what's going, you know, on in our life and what's available to us. I read an excellent article where it talks about addictions and why addictions are so prevalent. And it makes sense, doesn't it? Because the alcohol and drugs are available, they're cheap, and they don't require much work. Yeah. And they work. We achieve that break that we are so needing or desiring, right? Whereas doing this, talking about it, doing the work, self-exploring, learning, you know, experimenting with different things that are healthier is more expensive, inaccessible, and hard.
Yeah. Can I go back just on our discussion around first responders?
Sure.
And we know that the first responders in our life are expected to keep up a level of physical fitness. But when we think about the, again, emotional impacts of their roles, whatever they may be, what do you think, or do you have any recommendations for what organizations could do better to give those first responders the tools to process and manage the emotional trauma that they are undoubtedly going to face in their professional roles?
And you're 100% right that it's inevitable that they're going to see something, experience something. So I really think it needs to start at the recruitment level, where we're actually creating great protective factors and buffers so that as human beings, no matter what they're seeing, they're better equipped to handle it in that moment. They're more informed as to how to better take care of themselves versus trying to do it after the fact and figuring it out after the fact. So I really do think it starts at recruitment and training. And this is where, you know, my work with the post-secondary sector was, you know, 20 years ago, I was knocking on doors saying, you know, we're taking money from these students to prepare them for fire and prepare them for police. And we offer them technical skills. We offer them physical skills, getting them ready, all the exams and tests. We do nothing for the psychological preparation. And we're failing these people. And the response 20 years ago was, it's not an essential skill. It's not required by the employers. Therefore, it will receive no funding.
Wow.
And look where we are today. We are chasing the train. We could have been the engine. And now we're a caboose. We're not even a caboose. We're so far behind. And we've got medical systems now set up to, they're designed and set up for the generation that's going out, that's retiring. Because the current medical system, EAP programs, all the things that we've got set up for access and resources are nowhere prepared or equipped for the tsunami that is coming with the new generation.
They're dealing with the here and now, not the framework or the groundwork.
Well, the design was for a generation that didn't want to talk about mental health, that doesn't want to talk about vulnerability, that doesn't want to be viewed as ill. And we have a new generation of coming in that is very open about mental health, will use the system, will use those supports, and we're not equipped.
And a perfect segue, something that we haven't touched upon today is stigma. And you talked about, again, we're really focusing on the generation right now that was raised in a culture where we didn't talk about mental health. It was a taboo topic. And I am, you know, proud to say, you know, from what I'm experiencing as a mom, mental health isn't such a taboo topic anymore. I still imagine there's a lot of work to be done. But when we consider stigma, what barriers still exist from your perspective, whether it be for first responders or the general population?
Yeah, I think, you know, the pendulum has definitely swung the other way. And so I think there's going to be a little bit of bounce back to get to that balanced state, that balanced level of awareness and wording around mental health. So we went from nobody wants to talk about it to now everybody's talking about it, but they're not necessarily talking about it or experiencing it in the truest of ways, right? It's becoming, people are afraid that it's becoming a crutch or being used or misused now. And so we need to really spend time now educating and creating a balance in society where we're actually redefining what mental health is, redefining the sort of basis of the human experience, which is emotions, which we'll be discussing today in the keynote. Because that's where all the stigmas are starting from. They start from when we're young, right? Girls shouldn't get angry. Guys shouldn't cry. You know, sadness. We label emotions as either positive or negative, and they're neither. Emotions simply are. What if we used emotions as really a way of, again, calibrating where we're at, what we need, and what's going on, what really matters to us? Like really understanding the function of emotions, not labeling them positive or negative, and then stigmatizing them.
Yes, I think really, really, really important. As we look ahead to the future, and we consider all of the things from trauma to stigma to how we're supporting and creating a psychologically safe environment, as we start to wrap up this podcast, do you have any recommendations for individuals or organizations that say, I want to do better, and I commit to doing better starting tomorrow, and this is how I'm going to do it? What steps would you recommend, or resources do you recommend that people or organizations connect with?
I would say really just being open-minded to leaders. Definitely be open-minded and be open-eared, which means actually start to go out and have those conversations. Because a lot of the tools, a lot of the answers are already there in your organization. You've just got to be willing to listen and to find them. So a lot of the work that I do with organizations is bringing in all the stakeholders of the organization into a room where we explore these kinds of sensitive topics. And then kind of really talking to each other and discovering how this topic is experienced at all these different levels in all these different ways. And then sort of identifying what the core issue is and how do we as a team, as a collective, really start to make change. This process really helps because most people resist change. Most organizations and leaders, when they try to make change, people are like, no, 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 we don't want that. But all of a sudden, it changes when we experience it in this way because people already have a stake in it. They've already had a part in informing that change. People feel heard, valued, and that they belong. So already there, not only are we dealing with the actual issues, but we're now also creating that connected culture.
That's excellent. Just wrapping everything up and I want to part ways in a really meaningful way and thank you for your time with us today. I feel like you've shared so much information that will be useful, and we're so thankful today that you will be joining us as a keynote speaker at our annual celebration. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to MindVine, the podcast for Ontario Shore Centre for Mental Health Sciences. I'm Julie Van Hardingsveld. I hope you enjoyed today's episode with our incredible guest, Sejal Bellet. As a mental health professional, Sejal has shared her expertise with us with regards to well-being, human connection, positive transformation and growth for individuals and organizations. We talked about stigma and the tools that organizations and resources should consider when building a psychologically safe and more positive culture within their environment. Thank you for being such an inspiring guest, and thank you to our listeners for joining us today. Make sure you tune in next time for more insightful conversations on mental health and well-being. I should share, however, that we are taking a summer hiatus, and we'll check back in with you in the fall.
Make sure to like and subscribe
and turn on post notifications. Thank you for watching MindVine Podcast.